Well, as I said in the last session, that which is symbolized has to be a lot greater than the symbol, doesn't it? So no matter how great our imagination is, the reality is greater. No matter how good the illustration is, that which is illustrated is much greater than the illustration. So that was designed to be kind of a mind and heart stretcher. And we hope that it was. So for this session, we'll get our feet back down on the ground. Good, that didn't belong on the cassette anyway. Well, 2 Timothy 2:2. Would somebody refresh my memory on what that verse is? Okay, so there's a sequence there. Paul, Timothy, faithful men, and others. That's what he was emphasizing, wasn't it? My home state is Missouri. And one of my ancestors used to raise mules. And one winter, when he didn't have too much to do, he decided he'd round up a bunch of mules, take them down to Kansas City, and market them. Now, the bad thing was that everybody else in that part of Missouri had the same thought the same week. So the market was so glutted with mules at Kansas City that he couldn't get enough money to pay the freight to get them back home. So he said to the buyer, let's enter into a little sporting proposition here. He said, if you'll give me a dollar, he said, I got 30 mules out there in those two cars. If you give me a dollar for the first one, and then $2 for the second one, and then $4 for the third one, and $8 for the fourth one, and just double it, you can have the 30 that way. So the buyer shook hands, said it's a deal. And they set out to figure up the bill. Well, you know what happened. That there wasn't enough money in Kansas City to pay for that 30th mule because his price was in excess of $2 billion for the last one. Well, that's what multiplication does, isn't it? You know, Paul, Timothy, the faithful man to others. How did this earth get populated anyway? Every generation reproduced. If there had been any generation that didn't reproduce, we know what would happen. God seems to be very strong on reproduction from the very beginning. And I'd like to point out a couple of things in Genesis chapter 1 that might have not been emphasized the last time that you read it. Genesis 1:11. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself. And verse 12, he goes on, after its kind, whose seed is in itself. What was God trying to emphasize right in the very beginning? That anything that he created, an apple or an orange, had to have the most important thing was not the temporary apple or orange. It was that it had to have the seed of reproduction in itself. Now, would you agree with me that's the emphasis in there? Why would he mention that? It's important to him that the seed of reproduction is to be in every part of God's creation. So, 2 Timothy 2:2 may be referring to a reproductive process. Now, we're getting into something practical here, I trust, in a minute. But I'd like for us to go into John chapter 17 for a minute. This was Christ's last night on earth. And we really find out what was on his heart in John 17. Particularly when we notice that he mentioned the world 19 times. If repetition is any key to importance, would you get a clue as to what was on his heart? He mentioned the world 19 times. Here in Colorado Springs, we have a rodeo every year and import some celebrities from out in your part of the country to keep the crowds up. So one year, they imported a cowboy who was starring in a series on TV called Wells Fargo. Name was Cliff Robertson. Isn't that who he was? So he came here as a cowboy, and the first performance, he kind of startled everybody, turned out all the lights, put the spotlight on him, and let him want to sing. So instead of performing, he sang a song. And the song that he chose was, "He holds the whole world in his hand." You familiar with the song? I was sitting next to one of our overseas missionaries. He'd never heard the song before. He said, "You know, he's almost got it right." I think he thinks maybe Cliff had composed the song. But he said he needs to change one word. And that is that he holds the whole world in his heart. Now, that is more accurate, isn't it? So in John 17, Christ mentioned the world 19 times. The whole world was preoccupying his attention. Now, I think the first time I read John 17, I felt sorry for Christ. Here he was, the end of 3.5 years of intensive ministry, about to be crucified instead of crowned. And not much to show. Kind of a motley crew he'd gathered together there to show for his time. And I really felt sorry for him. But one night, I was over in Jerusalem. And ever since I'd been a Christian, I'd had the desire to go out into the foot of the Mount of Olives, near the garden, the brook. And I thought, well, if Christ could spend all night out there, maybe I could too. So I went out there with that intention, just to spend, as much of the night as I wanted to. Had a flashlight with me. Opened up and read in all the Gospels the account of Christ's last night on earth. And then came to John 17. Read it aloud. Nobody there but me and some dogs that were barking. And it took on an entirely new light because I saw for the first time a triumphant Christ. As he said in verse 4, "I have finished the work which you gave me to do." And then if we could interpolate a little bit, he said, "I have made provision," verse 21, "that the world may believe." Verse 23, "that the world may know." Christ was not in defeat. He was in great triumph. As he said, "I finished the work that you gave me to do, the result of which is, it is now possible for the whole world to know and the whole world to believe." And he gives the clue in here as to what he was talking about. As he said in verse 6, three phrases here, he talks about the men which you gave me. Verse 8, "I have given them the word that you gave me." And in verse 18, "Just as you sent me, in my mind and in my plan, I have sent them. So as a result of this threefold plan, I'm a success. And the world may know and believe. I simply took the men you gave me, I gave them the word, and then I sent them out. Now I'd like to just recall here at this point to get the significance of this, what happened after those men went out. 30 years after the resurrection, Paul wrote in Colossians 1:23 two very astounding verses. And you may find out a way to interpret these other than what it says. But I haven't been able to do that yet. In Colossians 1:5 and 6, he's talking about the gospel. Verse 6, he says, which is come unto you as it is in all the world. Now that's what it says. 30 years after the resurrection, the gospel has come into all the world. Now we say, well, that was probably the Roman world. That was a localized world. But look across the page to 1:23, still talking about the gospel, last part of the verse, which ye have heard and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven. How wide had the word spread 30 years after the resurrection? If you didn't have any information other than that, what would you conclude? Tell me. What do you conclude from those two verses? I want to wait till I hear an answer. The gospel had gone out to the whole world. Isn't that what it indicates? Christ had the whole world in his heart. But on that last night, he said in great triumph, I took the men you gave me, I gave them the word you gave me, I've sent them out into the world. 30 years later, Paul wrote, the world has been evangelized. Now, does that stack up with the facts of history? Maybe you have read the Apologeticus of Tertullian. I want to read what he said. This was approximately 100 A.D. He was writing to the officials of the Roman Empire, and he was chiding them for their foolishness in the way they had treated the Christians. He says, we are but of yesterday, yet we have filled all the places you frequent, cities, lodging houses, villages, townships, markets, the camp itself, the tribes, town councils, the palace, the senate, and the forum. We're only, Christians haven't been around very long, but this is where we've flocked into. All you have left is your temples. Heathen temples, that's the only place we don't show up. For what war should we not have been fit and ready, even despite our inferiority in numbers? We who are so willing to perish, were it not better, according to our mind, to be killed rather than to kill? We could have fought you even without being rebels, simply by showing our ill will in separating from your politics. For if such a force of men as ours had broken away from you to some distinct corner of the world, your empire would have been covered with shame at the loss of so many citizens, no matter who they were. Well, if all the Christians withdrew from the empire, he said that there wouldn't be much left. Nay, your punishment would have been civic bankruptcy. Undoubtedly, you would have shuddered at your desolate condition, at the very silence and at the stupor of a world lying in death. We withdrew. You're finished. You would have been left with more foes than citizens. For nowadays, it is owing to the multitude of Christians that your foes are fewer. And then this final phrase, since nearly all the citizens of nearly all your cities are Christians. How could he get away with writing something like that? Well, it had to be the truth. I've discussed this with Waldron Scott, who's quite an authority on first century Christianity, and claims that 10% of the world was evangelized. I said, that's not what Colossians 1 says, and that's not what Tertullian said. But I showed him this and said, how do you get around this? Nearly all the citizens of nearly all your cities are Christians. And he said, well, most of the population lived in the country. Well, I don't know how many people there were that were Christians in the first century. But there seems to be some indication that there were quite a few of them. Would you reach that conclusion with me? Now, these men that Christ gave the word to, what happened to them? According to Fox's Book of Mars, let's look at a few of them. James, one of the apostles. As James was led to the palace of martyrdom, his accuser was brought to repent of his conduct by the apostle's extraordinary courage and undauntedness, and fell down at his feet to request his pardon, professing himself a Christian and resolving that James should not receive the crown of martyrdom alone. Hence, they were both beheaded at the same time. So this is James, the first of the apostles. The next one was Philip. He labored in Upper Asia. AD 54, he was scourged, thrown into prison, and afterwards crucified. Matthew. The scene of his labors was Parthian Ethiopia, in which latter country he suffered martyrdom, being slain with a halberd in AD 1960. The other James. He was elected to the oversight of the churches of Jerusalem and was the author of the epistle ascribed to James in the sacred canon. At the age of 94, he was beaten and stoned by the Jews and finally had his brains dashed out with a fuller's club. Matthias. He was stoned at Jerusalem and then beheaded. Andrew. He preached the gospel to many Asiatic nations, but on his arrival at Edessa, he was taken and crucified on a cross, the two ends of which were fixed transversely in the ground. Hence the derivation of the term St. Andrew's cross. Mark, not one of the 12. Mark was dragged to pieces by the people of Alexandria. Peter. Among many other saints, the blessed apostle Peter was condemned to death and crucified, as some do write at Rome. Peter, perceiving his suffering to be understood, returned into the city. Jerome says that he was crucified with his head down and his feet upward, himself so requiring, because he was, he said, unworthy to be crucified after the same form and manner as the Lord was. And then there was Paul and Jude and Bartholomew. He was at length cruelly beaten and then crucified by the impatient idolaters. Thomas, martyred by being thrust through with a spear. Luke traveled with Paul through various countries and is supposed to have been hanged on an olive tree by the idolatrous priests of Greece. Simon preached the gospel in Mauritania, Africa, and even in Britain, in which country he was crucified, A.D. 74. The only one of the 12 who died a natural death was John. Oh, he survived, but all the rest of them, a violent death. So whatever it was that Christ did for these people, worked pretty well. He said, I took the man you gave me, I gave him the word that you gave me, and I'm going to send him out into the world. The result of which is that the world will be evangelized. So, according to Tertullian, by 100 A.D., a lot of the Christian killers have been converted, and the majority of people were Christians. Well, we don't need to get into what we're going to talk about here this morning, so better not labor that any further. Some other things I'd like to say. But I'd like to suggest a project to you. Read the gospel sometime and try to account for Christ's time while he was on the earth in the last 3.5 years. Now, give him time to sleep, time to travel, time to preach, time to heal, everything that he did. And I think you'll find that 90% of his time is unaccounted for in those 3.5 years. But I think it can be accounted for. And I'm going to check this out one day. I don't know which one of the 12 I'm going to meet first, but when I meet one of them in heaven, I'm going to strike up a conversation something like this. I hear you were in a training program with Christ. Was that right? And I think you say, well, you might call it that. I say, now tell me, in our school system, we go to classes 9 months out of the year, 5 days a week, 3 or 4 hours a day. How about your program? You know, what were your hours? What were your days? What were your months? And I think the reply would be, well, it just happened that our program was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 months out of the year. And those 12 can give us a clue as to where that other 90% of the time went. In the process of giving them the word, it would appear that Christ imparted three things to these people. The first was knowledge. The second was skill. And the third was character. Now, I'd like to distinguish between these three. And I think we can do it with an illustration. Let's suppose that on the particular team that you're on or have been on or going to be on in the future, there's a conclusion that there isn't enough personal evangelism going on. So the leader said, we're going to cure that. I'll make up a curriculum and we'll have classes in personal evangelism. Now, if you make up a good curriculum about all the kind of people that you'll encounter, the indifferent and the backslidden and the cultists and those lacking assurance, you know, all these, you can make up a 6 month curriculum at 1 hour a week. So, you hold classes, 6 months, in how to do personal evangelism. Then everybody graduates, you get a certificate. And unless your class is different from every other in history, there will not be any discernible increase in the amount of personal evangelism that's taking place. But on the other hand, if the instructor, first night of the class, looks for the most responsive person in the class, and after the class, he said, stick around. So he said, what are you doing next Thursday night? Well, don't reply. Just cancel. Meet me. Certain place, certain time. And I'm going to show you my prospect list for personal evangelism. I'll tell you how I got it. And then I'll show you how I make contact with people on the prospect list. And then we'll make an appointment. We'll go out and see somebody. And I'm going to show you how I open the conversation, how I deal with their objections, and if they're ready, how I lead them to Christ. We'll do this for 4 weeks. So they do it for 4 weeks. At the end of 4 weeks, He says, now next week you bring your prospect list, and I'm going to look over your shoulder while you make contact. And then I'll go with you to visit these people, but I'm not going to say anything unless you get in a jam. So the next 4 weeks, he goes with him and coaches him. Well, at the end of 2 months, you've got two people that are doing personal evangelism. So at the end of 2 months, you say to him, now, I'm going to take a new band, and you take one. So at the end of 4 months, you've got at least four people doing it. And if you repeat the process at the end of 4 months, at the end of 6 months, well, there's at least eight people doing it, right? Now, that's more than, you just teach. What I'm trying to put together here is knowledge is important and essential. But it has to be followed by skill. So the 6 months class is very important. But the leader of the class imparted not only knowledge, but skill. Now, at the end of the first 2 months, the first man, the man that started this whole thing, he called him up every Friday morning and said, how'd it go last night? And reflecting back, I think I got mixed up on my mathematics. There wouldn't be eight quite so soon because we took 2 months, didn't we? So you can correct that. But you get the principle anyway, there'd be more doing it. One way to correct that is just reduce the time down to where it will come out at eight. But he called him up every Friday morning and said, how'd it go last night? And that happens Friday after Friday after Friday. So finally, the first man, when he called him on Friday, he said, you know what? I don't think you're really that interested in what went on last night. I think you're just checking up on me to make sure I'm still doing it. He said, well, I've got news for you. You don't need to call me anymore and check up on me because something's happened. I'm just as interested in personal evangelism as you are. I'm just as highly motivated as you are. You don't need to check up on me. I think this is what he's talking about in Galatians 4:19, where that Paul writing to Galatians says, my little children, of whom I travail in birth until Christ be formed in you. You see, this man had developed the same character as the first man. He had the same motivation. He didn't need to be checked up on anymore. So Christ somehow imparted knowledge, skill, and character to where 11 out of the 12 plus a few more did the same thing he did. Most of them were crucified because they wouldn't deny their faith. They had his character and went to the same limits that he did. Paul gives us a further clue to this kind of ministry, and I'll try to put this together as we conclude. 1 Thessalonians 2:11. First chapter of Thessalonians 1, Paul gives them a pretty broad compliment in which he said, now, the most of the people I visit, I got a pretty long list of things to exhort them on. But he says, you people, my list is blank. He said, in fact, I haven't visited any place in the world where they haven't told me about your faith and influence. You've got a worldwide ministry right now, and I'm sorry, I just don't have anything to exhort you on. Then he gives an account in the second chapter, maybe I should say a clue, that contributed to their effectiveness. Verse 11. He says, and you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his children. The New English translation of this verse says, as a father does his children, one by one. Now, as I read that, I was greatly amused. My wife and I have done our part to fulfill the first commandment in the Bible, which is to be fruitful and multiply. So we've done our share. As I thought back over the family we've brought up, I thought, now, I wasted a lot of time. What we should have done was kept a detailed diary, hour by hour, as to how we raised the first one. Then when the second one came along, you just pull out the diary and repeat the same process all the way through. Wouldn't that work pretty well? You wouldn't have to think, just go through the checkoff list. You don't think that'd work? Huh? Why wouldn't it work? Well, their needs will just never be the same at the same chronological age. Not any ways near the same. In fact, there's just no pattern at all between the first one and the second one, or between the third and the first and the second. And how many of you have children here? Well, you know what I'm talking about here, don't you? Now, is it any different with Christians? Can't you just give the new Christian a book and say, now, the first hour, the first day you do this, and the second hour, the second day you do this, and third hour, you do this? Wouldn't that work just fine? No, a new Christian needs a parent that is very versatile in their approach and understanding, because the needs of two Christians are not the same at the same chronological point in time. So Paul said, when I came to Thessalonica, that I just singled you out one at a time and dealt with you the way that a parent does with his children, one by one. And he had a lot to show for what he did there in Thessalonica. Lorne Senni, our president, was visiting behind the Iron Curtain a while back, talking with a Christian man over there. And he said, in the Stalinist era, we really had to be careful. There was no way any two people could get together. But he said, there wasn't any law against taking a walk. So he said, I had six or seven young men, and we took long walks together. And he said, I taught them in the scripture, Christian life, memorized all these things. And he said, every one of those seven is a Christian of great stature in our country today. Well, he said, then the pressure eased off, and we began to have small meetings. And he said, there hadn't been any stalwart Christian that's come out of those. He said, I'm glad that the Navigators are working here, because we're being reminded of the importance of man to man, ma'am to ma'am, personal, individual time with an individual. I think it's not fair to compare ourselves with Christ, who had unlimited capacity. He could do things in groups that we could not do. But Paul picked up the principle. As we read in 1 Thessalonians 2, one by one. I'd like to comment on the importance of this. I was talking one day with a naval officer friend of mine, a jet pilot, and he said, you people, the Navigators, are, you're hung up on this man-to-man individual emphasis. He said, I like to teach the Bible. I recognize the importance of it. But he said, every time I take an hour, I want as many people as I can get to be exposed to the Word of God. But he said, I've noticed that your people seem to last and mine don't. And he said, maybe you got something there. Could you give me a clue? I said, well, Hal, I'll try it here. And in order to do that, I said, I want to review your jet training. Now, as long as I'm telling the truth, you give me the affirmative nod. But if I stray, well, give me a signal. So I told him about his ground school, classroom, all this. And I said, finally, after about 14 months, one day your instructor said, fellows, a great day has arrived. Now, there's 30 of you in class. There's 30 trainers sitting out there on the runway. Now, each one of you go out and call in one. I want to see what you can do. You go, no, not the way it happened. That point, you're all right up to this point, but not that. So what did happen? And a pained expression came on his face. He says, that guy, he was on my back every day from early in the morning to late at night. He said, you'll never learn to fly. You're going to kill both of us. And, I could tell it was a rough experience. I said, Hal, are you telling me that the Navy assigned one man? You're a Lieutenant J.G., Lieutenant Commander. And that all he did was just teach you to fly? One person? Now, one guy taught another to fly? He said, yeah. And he said, I see the point. You don't need to get any further. Well, I said, how long does it take to train an elevator operator? How long does it take to train an elevator operator? How long do you think? Tell me. 5 minutes? Yeah. I know what you're going to do with the other four, but then we'd be liberal. I said, Hal, you can determine the importance of a task by the amount of personal individual attention that it takes to get the job done. Flying a jet aircraft is pretty complicated. It takes quite a bit of man-to-man training. Running an elevator is not that complicated. It doesn't take very much man-to-man. In fact, you could probably read a book or just maybe even read the directions posted in the thing and learn to operate it. Most important job in the world is training Christians to reproduce. And it takes a little bit of time and a little bit of effort. But it pays off. Paid off for Christ. Paid off for Paul. As something happened in that first century. Now, I think there's no mystery to the principle behind 2 Timothy 2:2. It just says that we set in operation a chain of reproduction. Paul, I gave it to Timothy. Now, don't let it die with Timothy. Timothy, you pass this on to faithful men. Okay? And those faithful men are supposed to pass it on to another generation. That's what's supposed to happen. Now, if somebody had left their faith in Christ and their desire to serve Him stop with them, you wouldn't be here today, would you? You're here because somebody believed in taking at least one step further than themselves. But it's interesting. It's very easy almost to teach somebody to do what you've done. But when they have reproduced and you've got a grandchild, there's a whole different set of problems. It takes a lot more skill to help a person beyond the first stage into the third stage and even more into the fourth. I don't want to elaborate on that. I just want to be practical. If this is so important, why isn't it more widely practiced? I think there are two reasons. One, because it's hard work, and it's not all that glamorous. And the other is that we have to expose ourselves to do it, because a time will come when the person that you're working with will say to you, if that's such a hot idea, how come you don't practice it yourself? We expose ourselves when we get in this kind of a contact with another person, don't we? We've got to set the pace. I think that's two reasons that we don't do more of it. But I feel there's one other area here, and then we'll try to wind up. I was traveling from here down to Texas one fall right after Thanksgiving. Just happened that three of the fellows in the car were all single people. We traveled all the way to San Antonio and covered a lot of subject matter as we were driving. And I was just sure that sometime before that journey was through, that those three single men, knowing I was happily married, were going to bring up a subject of Christian romance and marriage. And so, sure enough, they did. And I don't know how many hours we talked, but we spent a lot of time on the subject. I think everything that needed to be said had been said. Then we finally shifted to another subject, which was man-to-man, reproductive thing. And they said, why is it necessary? I said, well, fellows, this couldn't come at a more opportune time. Now, you remember what we've been talking about the last several hours? Oh, they did. I said, I predict that before this trip is over, every one of you three will catch me aside sometime and say, hey, you remember the other day when we were talking about that Christian romance and marriage bit? I got a question that wasn't answered. And you know what all three of those guys did? They said, well, we already have that in mind. I said, why waste the time? Speak up, man. No, ask me now. Why do we have to wait till we get off in the corner sometime? I can only see one problem. If all three of you happen to be interested in the same girl, I can see where that'd be a problem. But you don't have to mention any names or give any descriptions, you know. Just be vague about what's going on, but not a one of them would do it. You see, you can't find out what's really in a person's heart and mind in a crowd. Can you? I think there's not a church in the country, but whatever Sunday, there are people sitting out in front of the preacher that have never heard him give the answer, the preacher give them an answer to their particular problem. Therefore, they have concluded there is no answer. And they plateau, settle down in a rut. However, a little private interview might pinpoint the problem in their growth, and they might be amazed to find that somebody else has been down that road before and that there is a solution. And then once that solution has been reached, there's a new period of growth. But people will not reveal their innermost feelings in a crowd. Is that right? Now, I haven't been very practical, but what do you do in, personal training? Pass it on to somebody so he in turn can pass it on to another. I had a letter one day from a chaplain stationed over in Spain, an Air Force chaplain. And he said, every place I've been in the Air Force since I've been a chaplain, I've had a great bunch of young men around. You know, we really had a thing going there. And he said, when I would check up and find out the background, you know, I found out that the nucleus of this group had always been trained by the navigators. He says, now I'm at the new base in Spain, and I don't have any like this. Would you send me some literature that I can pass out so I can get a group of men like this? Yeah, I don't have any nice base. Well, you can be sure that I took my time in composing the answer of that letter. And it was about 3 pages long. I said, Chaplain, I'm sorry that we do not have any literature that we can send you that will raise up a bunch of men like you've described. But I tell you what to do. Pick out the most likely one that you see and tell him you'd like to see him during a week. And when you call him in, ask him if he does any Bible study. And if he doesn't, you tell him, well, I study the Bible every week, and here's the way I go about it. And why don't you and me have a Bible study together? Well, I won't labor this, but then you go into a quiet time, and then you go into how to witness, and then develop your life and all these things. Tell him what your vision is for the world and what you're doing about it. And try to see that he's got a God-given vision and gets on with it. And just, you know, about 3 pages of the things you'll do. And I say, Chaplain, the reason that you've had men of the type you've described at every command you've been is because somebody sat down with those men as individuals and did what I've told you to do. That's the way they got into existence. It wasn't through literature. And if you want some of that kind of man, it's within a possibility to get them. But this is what you got to do. Well, 2 Timothy 2:2 did not provide for the message to stop with any one person, but to be a reproducible influence and emphasis right on down. After something's gone for 4 generations, it's got quite a bit of momentum, hasn't it? Paul didn't mean end with 4. You know, he just assumed that once it's got that much momentum, it'll keep rolling. Well, my thoughts haven't been very well organized, but I think there's a principle in 2 Timothy 2:2 that is very important. Let me conclude with this, and then if there's any questions or comments, why, we can take a little bit for them, since you don't eat till 12:30, but you don't have to stay here till 12:30. There's not a one of us in this room who knows how long we have to serve Christ. Anybody know? Anybody know how long you've got? I don't know, and I don't think you know. I think there's only one person that's ever lived who knew at the beginning of his ministry how long that he had. And that was Christ. He knew he had 3.5 years. With that kind of pressure, he had to select a plan that would not fail. He did select a plan that did not fail. And he reveals it to us in John 17. He said, well, I just took the men that you gave me, and I gave them the word that you gave me. And then when they were ready, I sent them out. Analytically, it would appear that in the curriculum was these 3 things. Knowledge, skill, and character. If that assumption is correct, the reason that the world is not being reached in our generation is because the plan is not being utilized in our generation. It'll work just as well today as it worked then. Any comment? Any question? Anybody has? Okay, Dave, you're back to you.
Thank you very much.
This for me, I'd like to, if you give me one of those, I'd like to order a tape of that first message. Give me an order one, because I get asked for it every once in a while, and I've never put together the way I want to, but I'll just use that for a start.
Okay, great.